CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, Delaney Consulting LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's services as outstanding and excellent. The SAP Business by Design solution is a single integrated business management solution that delivers the best of SAP software on demand, offering the benefits of larger applications without the need for a costly IT infrastructure. And Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and other financial executives. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And in this week's CFO Radio News, we bring an article from foodnavigatorusa.com. The food industry is one of the most well-respected industries in terms of social responsibility, according to a new survey from research-based consultancy Pensjön Berland. The second annual Corporate Social Responsibility Perceptions Survey, which was conducted in partnership with brand consulting firm Landor Associates and strategic communications firm Burson Marsteller, interviewed a nationally representative online sample of 1,001 U.S. consumers about their attitudes to corporate social responsibility efforts across 14 different industries. It found that the food industry, consumer goods, and retailers were seen as performing the best, and 75% of those surveyed said they thought it was important to examine companies' corporate social responsibility strategies. In addition, while only 13% of respondents said they had read about individual companies' CSR policies on their websites, 75% of those said, as a result, they were much more likely to purchase that company's products. And 72% of consumers said they would make some sacrifices in spending in order to support social responsibility. Managing Director for Corporate Responsibility at Burson Marsteller, Eric Beale, said, "Companies need to combine strong social responsibility programs with effective communication of what they're doing. While many consumers may not be precise in how they define terms like corporate social responsibility, they do have a clear sense of how they expect companies to behave. They expect companies to offer high-quality products at good prices and to explain how they treat their employees well, give back to their communities, and respect the environment. Those companies that can clearly articulate how they advance these values to consumers can achieve real benefits for their brands and overall reputation." Well, today's article is very relevant in the food industry, and we have Tony Mitchell, who joins us today to discuss the role of the CFO. Welcome to the show, Tony.
Thank you.
Tony, you are the Chief Financial Officer of Morrison Management Specialists, Inc., a $1.5 billion division of Compass Group PLC. Morrison is the nation's only food service company that's exclusively dedicated to providing food, nutrition, and dining services to the healthcare and senior living communities through two operating divisions, Morrison Healthcare Food Services and Morrison Senior Living. Morrison was a New York Stock Exchange-listed public company until it was acquired by Compass Group in 2001. And Compass Group has revenues of over $22 billion and operates 50 countries with more than 400,000 employees. Now, Tony, prior to joining Morrison, you served as CFO of two securities broker dealer firms, and you've experience in the technology industry as well as Big Eight public accounting. Your experience has been showcased in several executive panels, including CFO Magazine's Executive Performance Management Panel and MFHA's Diverse Executives Panel. You are a keynote speaker for CFO Magazine's National Conference, and you are an active volunteer speaker at Family Life's Weekend to Remember Marriage Conferences. You're chairman of the board of the Multicultural Food and Hospitality Alliance, mentioned earlier, MFHA.net, and also a certified public accountant. Well, Tony, in your current role, you oversee the finance function for Morrison. Let's start back at the beginning. Tell us, in your early career experience, and we've had some guests on the show describe their first job as being a gymnast, a mail delivery person. What was your first paying job, and how did you meander your way through to here?
My first paying job was actually baling hay on a farm. And then after that, I went to a mechanic, and my father was a truck driver, and I had a career-defining moment when I had to haul asphalt for asphalt to be put down on the road, it has to be 300 degrees by the time it hits the road. He had no air conditioning, and that was going to be my job in the future. So at that moment, I defined my career as I'm going to go to college. And that's when I had started to have a drive to really succeed.
There's nothing like hard labor to make you decide what you want to do, right?
That's right. That's right.
So how did that asphalt to food?
Yes.
What happened in between?
Well, when I got to college, I was very good at math and very accomplished in that. First major was to be a math teacher. And I've always enjoyed teaching, mentoring, and coaching. And as I looked into that career path, I said, well, maybe I want to apply my math skills to business. So I got into the business school, found out what a CPA was, and then defined that that was going to be my career. And then that transitioned through Big A Public Accounting into the technology arena, securities broker-dealer, and then food industry for the last 12 years.
Now, knowing that training and mentorship is very important to you, did you have a particular mentor early on in your stage of decision-making that helped you go through that channeling?
Yes, many mentors. There's many people all the way from my math teacher in high school, another math teacher in college. Once I got to college, it's a different study skill set. Many mentors along the way. I've always sought out people that I've looked at and said there's something about them that either inspires me or there's something about them that's different. And I want to understand what that difference is and then either incorporate it. And many times you can learn a lot from people that are extremely different in a negative way. Maybe they're a little bit too hard as a teacher or something else. And you want to observe that to understand, well, maybe I don't want to do that. And what I do want to do is what my other teacher may inspire me in.
So the numbers were a passion for you from early on.
Yes. Yes.
So what led you in terms of the passion that you have today? One of the things that we like to talk about is passion, what drives you. And in our earlier conversations, I understand that you're very passionate about leadership of the business, a focus which incorporates not only leading the finances of the business, but also the people. So let's break that down into two components. First, knowing the business. As a CFO, how do you do that?
Knowing the business, you really have to get close to the business, and it's not just through the numbers. Many times you will have to spend time in the units with frontline employees, with our clients, and get to know what's in their mind. Many times what they say they need isn't necessarily what they truly need. But if you understand what keeps them up at night, if you understand what their challenges are as either a frontline employee or a client, then you're better able to meet the needs of your frontline employees and your clients.
So to what extent do you balance the time frame in terms of learning the business? How much time, let's say you're starting a new role, how much time do you designate? Do you do a big 1, 2, 3 month roadshow, go to the physical locations, see the widgets being performed? If it's a service organization, see the services being performed?
I think for myself, I spend more time up front. And what I become very guilty of is once you learn the business, then you automatically start to spend more time thinking about strategy, thinking about implementation, thinking about tactics. And you end up spending less time in the field than you should. At least that's what I'm guilty of. For example, when I first went into the role of a VP of finance for one of our divisions, I spent 3 months going around the country to all the different accounts and regional offices to be able to understand what are the challenges from a financial function that our frontline employees, our in-field management had in serving our clients, and what could finance do to empower them to better serve our clients and better serve our employees. Once you figure that out, you're a hero, because then you go back, put it together, then execute and deliver on it. And the finance function now adds more value than just providing data.
And do you find that being the new guy on the block or the new person in that position, that people are a little shy about being forthcoming? Because that, to some extent, is a role that an internal audit function might perform. They would ask a lot of questions. Maybe an outside consulting firm would do the same. And now, heck, we've got the boss coming and doing the same.
Yes. It's really how you position it. A lot of times when I position it, I go into the accounts or I go into the field, especially in that case when I was in that position, and said, we're going to create a finance function that looks different than what we have today, and I'd like you to be part of that creation. Can you help me? Then all of a sudden, it's not an audit function, or you're not trying to shoot holes in what they're doing. You're really creating something new. So you set a vision out into the future. You talk about what the plan's going to be, and you're going to give the feedback of what that plan is back to the individuals that provided the input, and then you execute.
So that's taking us on to stage two. Secondly, as a leader of the people, you are very much a supporter of helping, I'll say, the people, whether that's on the internal side, the employee base, and maybe vendors and suppliers and so forth, but it's also customers on the far end. You're a very strong mentor, and that has been something very much meandered through your entire career. Expand a little bit on being the leader of people, and particularly as we look at being the leader of finance people. We ourselves don't come necessarily naturally from the emotional side of our brain. We tend to use the other side of our skill set. So how do you foster that support and knowledge and nurturing, not only in yourself, but also those that are coming behind you? How do you help that?
People really want to have someone that they can lock arms with in order to accomplish the impossible. So we're driven towards a vision. So first we have to set a vision for everyone that even, for example, in a tough economic times like we have today, we are going to be doing more work with less. If we either have fewer people because of layoffs, fortunately for Morrison, we haven't done that, or we're not going to hire additional people and we do experience growth and therefore there's more work, we have to, as a leader, decide to say, you know, this is going to be a difficult time. We will make it through. And if there was a team I wanted to assemble and hire today, you would be on that team. So together, we are going to be able to accomplish this. And this is how. So you can't just say that. You have to have a vision, then you have to have a plan, and then you have to execute on it. And people want to follow that. They want to hear the reality of, my leader knows that we're working harder than ever. And my leader has a plan on how we're going to alleviate that in the future and has a vision that we'll be able to accomplish reducing that workload into the future.
A lot of what you said, Tony, has been around communication. And having spent much of my career going into companies as perhaps an executive or consultant, if you will, in that advisory capacity, I've seen time and time and time again that one of the challenges that leadership has and one of the areas that employees typically would say a poor position or a poor job is being done is that of communication. As a CFO, we tend to communicate a lot to the outside, to the analyst, to the shareholder, and so forth, to that customer. Do you have a particular philosophy regarding that communication style, how much it should be done, who should do it, when you should do it? Do you have particular philosophies in that communication path?
For the outside or internal?
For the inside.
For internal.
Well, let's start with the inside.
For internal, I always believe I communicate too little. I always can communicate more. Many times I look for opportunities to not necessarily send an email, but if someone's in the building, to walk down the hall and have a conversation, or if they're not in the building, to pick up the phone and have a call.
So making it that much more personal touch.
Yes, indeed. And that personal touch in good times and tough times goes a long way to building a camaraderie that we are together. We're on the same team to make this happen. And sometimes it's difficult to do that in an email. Again, very guilty of overusing email because of its efficiency, but at the same time, seek opportunities to make a personal contact, and that fosters better communication.
And our town hall meetings, perhaps they're locally called that, to gather the employees around. Is that something that you should do? Do you have to be cautious about what you tell those employees just in case, oh, well, I haven't yet told the analysts, or maybe today somebody's got a cell phone and a recorder?
Yes, you do have to be very careful. Many times, when we are at either regional meetings or we have employee national meetings or national meetings with employees, you want to provide the vision, and especially if it's already articulated through public disclosure, you want to provide that vision in a way that resonates with all the employees, all the teammates, and all the associates of the organization, so that then they can say, I get where we're going. And that becomes the why for some of the decisions that you start to roll out and execute, because they understand the full picture.
And I think also my experience has shown that it isn't actually quite so much what you say. It's the fact that you're there, the fact that as a leader, you're opening yourselves.
Yes.
And a very healthy question and answer session will actually tell you an awful lot of things. I have been surprised many times in my lifetime to see how direct employees will ask those questions in an open public forum.
Yes.
They'll actually tell you what you need to hear.
Absolutely. And many times it's not necessarily seeking that information in the crowd once they know who you are, but it's before you're speaking, or if you're in an account talking to individuals that maybe they're standing behind the food preparation area, maybe they're in the kitchen, maybe they're somewhere that normally someone doesn't just step up and say, what do you think about what's going on? What's working? What's not? And they're very honest. And it's incredible because they're like, you actually asked me, well, I'm not going to let you down by not giving you the truth. And they're inspired that you actually asked them, and you get more truth than you typically would do otherwise.
And you've opened yourself to them. It's a very strong open door policy.
Yes.
To physically be there. Well, let's talk a little bit about the work of being the CFO. What is the main focus for the role for the CFO in your mind? Is it more about juggling the multiple hats of tactical and strategic, i.e. getting payroll out on Friday, as well as shareholder value and what the balance sheet is saying? What is that focus for you?
For a CFO, the focus is on multiple fronts. It is very much time slicing the value that you have to deliver to shareholders, to a parent company who would be your shareholder, to the employees, to your colleagues, to the senior management team, to the front line, and delivering not only data. A good CFO is going to deliver more than just data, more than just the financial reporting, more than just the financial side of the company. They're going to deliver, how does that tie in with where we're going, where we've been, and what can we do to repeat the success of the past or overcome the mistakes or the failures of the past, failures being the best teacher out there.
And those are sometimes tough to spot, and
yes.
Sometimes even when you spot them, they're even tougher to admit.
Yes, yes. And admitting them, people respect leadership more when they admit the failures, call them for what they are, and then say, this is what we're going to do to overcome that failure.
And in fact, part of the nemesis for this radio show is actually in order to give great CFOs such as yourself the opportunity to talk about your career, the bumps in the road. I don't think any of us has had a perfection in life or business or career.
No.
And certainly, not only can you see your own weaknesses and failures, but you can learn from others.
Yes. Absolutely.
So we're juggling. We now have a CFO that's got multiple hats. You are managing payroll. You're managing getting the cash reporting every day and all the intricacies there. Is there any particular aspect of the finance function that you think perhaps is much, much more tactical? We tend to think of elements of maybe financial planning as more strategic. We tend to think of those AR, AP, cash-related cycles. What tends to happen is that you're going to split them up in terms of headcount, and you tend to have an accounting function and then obviously the financial planning and forward-looking M&A type function.
Mm-hmm.
How do you attribute a balance to your time in terms of splitting that? How do you manage? Obviously, the people aspect is very key, the strategic aspect, and quite frankly, as CFO, you're the one that could have the handcuffs on. So how do you manage that tactical day-to-day? Let's say you've got a challenge and you've got to focus your time on two different things today, both of which are critical. One's getting the payroll out and doing the cash reporting, and the other is something strategic for the board. How do you make that prioritization?
In a practical sense, how you accomplish it is having great people. If you have a fantastic controller and a fantastic VP of finance, which I believe I do have, then you have two people that can execute and deliver. And in those times of difficulty or stress where you're trying to reprioritize what's going on, you have a team of two people along with yourself that you can then go execute what you need to accomplish. So, for example, the tactical of the VP of the controller VP is to be able to deliver that data. And many times you will have something occur that's going to knock you off of a closing cycle, but you still have to close the books timely and roll up the numbers. Then someone from finance, someone from somewhere else in the accounting function, or someone else another part of the team can then jump in and help our team member who needs to expedite a process in order to still meet the closing deadline. And the same would be true for finance. So it's going to boil down to having great people that are versatile and can step from whatever their normal function is, step into another function and help someone out. And the controller has helped out our finance immensely. So we can cross those lines.
Crossing the barriers between the finance and the accounting. And something that you mentioned there, Tony, you mentioned a couple of times process. And let's face it, checks need to be signed. In today's world, that can all be done electronically. And
yes.
The print facility may actually be somewhere outsourced.
Yes.
The finance function in terms of controls and balance and process tends to be perhaps more people-driven than it is systematic. The accounting in today's world tends to be more informational system-driven. Are there different aspects as to the physical mechanics of those processes?
There are differences. I think you've articulated a couple of the differences. We also need to compensate for those differences so that in accounting, it does become people-oriented. When we've had our town hall meetings or regional meetings, as we've called them, as our accounting supervisors and managers has visited those meetings, there's often been times that they've received a standing ovation for the service they provide to our field personnel. So that's more than just the numbers. In our financial people, understanding how to navigate the accounting aspects of recording the data that all of our field has to record is a significant value that our finance function adds. So we can cross those lines and compensate for the stereotype that accounting is just data and not service, and finance is more service and less data.
Yeah, it's very interesting. If you've come up through the accounting ranks, through the controllership function, you do tend to be looked at from the outside as the bean counter. And
right.
One of the dilemmas that I think occurs in the U.S. is when you use the term accountant. I obviously have a very international background, and country to country, this doesn't tend to happen. But in the U.S., people tend to just put you in the bucket of tax.
Yes.
And the first thing you have to do is to explain what you're not.
Right.
But obviously the bean counting is a very significant part of that. And you also touch upon accuracy and timeliness in what you're saying in terms of process. Do you have a part of your function, and have you perhaps speak to the efficiency that you mentioned? How do you, let's say, strategically decide, okay, I'm going to look at this particular area, let's say my AR function. We're not particularly streamlined. In order to enhance and improve that process, you essentially divert your people's time away from closing the books, for lack of a better term. How do you balance the prioritization of that effectiveness, efficiency improvement versus just getting it done?
Yes, yes. Many times we've done that. I also have technology as part of the responsibilities. So, for example, when we're looking at building an efficiency in accounts receivable as an example, or accounting and closing the books for the individual units, it is always the priority to close the books. That's the priority.
So period number one, if you've got any doubt, that's the priority.
You have to. There's no, everybody relies on those books getting closed timely. Our business managers that are in the field, our leadership within the company, our shareholder in this case, or shareholders when we were public, count on that closing. So that's priority. Then we go to the leadership of accounting, so the managers, the supervisors, the vice presidents, and say, how are we going to find time to improve processes? We integrate that leadership with the technology leadership, who are going to build the tools in order to make accounting more efficient, and then discover ways that we can either write programs or actually purchase programs, outsource it, in order to build that efficiency into the process. Most of the time, how we can improve the process, 90% of the time, is not going to come from an outside person. It's not going to come from even the VPs. It's often going to come from the supervisors, the managers, the clerks, the people that do it day in and day out. They can write a better process. And then we just have to have the technology put it into code.
So part of that is helping them take the accountant hat off.
Yes.
And helping them, that comes back to the nurturing of the people, helping them create and provide them with the skills.
Yes.
Such that they can essentially be a process reviewer, which is a very different skill set. Again, it's a different kind of the brain.
Yes. And it's creating that vision that we are going to create a new future, and we need you to have input or even drive what that future is going to look like. So it's not decided. It's not decided by IT. It's not decided by the CFO. It's not decided by anyone else. That answer is going to come out of us getting together and defining that future.
Very team-oriented vision for people. And you mentioned IT. We're going to get onto a couple of different topics, but before we maybe go into some of those that we've planned, I'd like to talk about your role managing the technology function. Very many of the CFOs that have sat in your seat today have talked about either a current overseeing or a potential future overseeing of information technology. And I've managed CIOs in the past, and very candidly, they tend not to want the CFO to manage them.
Yes.
Because they want the seat at the board. They want information systems to be thought of as more globally than finance. This is a change from 10 and 20 years ago. So perhaps if you could talk a little bit to the evolution of that role as it has impacted you as being the CFO.
Yes, one of the best things that happened to me is the CEO before the CEO that's my business partner at this time put me into the CIO role. At the time, I questioned whether or not I wanted to do it because I did want to stay into finance. I was able to go into that role simply because you can speak both languages. I could speak the language of technology and finance at the same time, and business strategy, where we're going. That was probably one of the best things I could have done, because then when I now speak of technology, there's a credibility of being in that position and being able to speak to those needs and crossing the bridge, crossing the lines to be able to also speak from a strategy of the global company. That delivers a lot, not only to the company, but it also delivers a lot to technology, because you can get it. A lot of times I think either CIOs or senior leaders within technology feel that the CFO doesn't get it. So spend time with technology, learn it enough to understand it and get it, so that you can actually help the CIO and the organization and technology succeed at the very things they want to do, which is to add value, do more than just keep the lights on, add value and make a difference. If you help them make a difference, then they're proud to be a part of the team.
And obviously, technology is at a key element, a very big big budget line item when it comes to any kind of an improvement.
Yes.
They are the experts that help put in the change that you're describing. Yeah, we're seeing much more of the CFO positions managing that technology function, and I think we're going to see more and more of it.
I expect the same.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about another aspect of the finance function and the CFO role. The CFO often leads not only the role of the accounting and the finance, but also pursuing potential companies to acquire, if you will, looking at what could potentially grow that bottom line as well as top line, sometimes through organic means, working with the sales team, sometimes through acquisitions. Now, I'm going to step back to a previous role that you've had, and you were a CFO of investment broker, dealer corporation, and obviously now with Morrison. Describe a little bit about any roles that you have had through acquisition processes. Have you been the acquirer, or have you been the acquiree, or both?
Have been both. I'm fortunate, very fortunate in my experience with a broker dealer, is that one of the broker dealers I worked with grew completely organically, and the other one grew predominantly through acquisition. At Morrison, we have two divisions. One division has grown organically, and the other division has grown through acquisition. Very fortunate to see both organic and acquisition growth. And Morrison was acquired by Compass Group, as you mentioned earlier, so been on the acquiree end of that also. It's exciting. There's several different exciting parts of being a CFO. Everything from accounting, which sometimes people think is not as exciting, but it certainly can be when structured right. Technology, finance, and either being the acquirer or the acquiree.
Come on, I need to be the advocate for accounting. Really is fun.
Yes, it is.
And I've got into the forensics, and that really is where it starts getting a lot of fun. So you've been in those, both of those. Let's talk a little bit about the acquisition by Compass, and I don't want to ask you to give any kind of confidential information. That's
certainly
not a place we're going to go. But you became a subsidiary of a company whose stock is listed on the UK Stock Exchange. What impact, if any, did that have? And I'd like perhaps for you to answer to two aspects of that. One is the foreign and the international aspect. Now you're reporting under a new regulation or series of regulations.
Yes.
But the second is now you're the little bear.
Yes.
And big bear just ate you up.
Yes. Yes, indeed. It's been better than expected. Most certainly when you're an entrepreneurial public company and you can do things directly with the CEO and talk to the board directly, you have more latitude, more ability to execute on your plans with less approval process. So certainly walking into it, there was a trepidation that there was going to be too much bureaucracy to be able to deliver the fantastic results we had experienced.
Well, particularly Compass is a massive company.
Massive.
I mean, how does company rank in terms of all corporations in terms of size? Is it up there as one of the top ones?
It is. Compass is, depending which list you look at, between the 9th and the 12th largest employer in the world. So it's extremely large. And what's beautiful about Compass and what really exceeded my expectations is they had told us when they acquired Morrison that they were going to come in and allow us to do what we do very well and continue to do that. Synergize in areas that make sense, but not get in the way. Keep our brand identity. So we have portfolio approaches. Every one of the individual business sectors have their own name. And Compass is just the parent company. And they've allowed us to really execute on that. For over 10 years now, or close to 10 years now, we are still Morrison. We still have our division. We still have our offices and leadership, and we're still able to execute. Then they have piled on top of that opportunities for individuals, opportunities for financing, opportunities to go into new markets, a lot of opportunities that you don't have at the same level when you're in an independent company. So those opportunities have been tremendous. There is bureaucracy. I think any company is going to have that. It is much less than I expected, and it's actually been enjoyable to actually take all the opportunity, be able to still have the autonomy that you have as Morrison, and execute with this big resource behind you that can help you deliver on all those promises.
And that is a very challenging aspect of an acquisition. Very often we've had CFOs sit in your seat and they've talked about, well, the value never really came, or we've had M&A guys sitting there and gals that have talked about the value and what they expected going into it, the multiple perhaps never will come.
Right.
And, you know, you look at the multiples that Google's and some of those, you know, .com type companies had, those are astronomical values to be able to place on a business. But I think you've hit on the nub of benefits of good, well-priced cash.
Yes.
From
yes.
the parent company, yes. Assuming they've got the cash, which is in the economy we've just been through is a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm.
But they seem to have balanced in your situation the need and for you to be able to be autonomous and still be that nimble entrepreneurial company. So many times we see acquisitions where a company will buy a company because it's good at what they do, and then they come in and change everything.
Right.
And they've just taken away what made it good.
Right, right. And we've experienced, even within Compass, sometimes you start to see that, but the leadership within our organization pushes back, and the leadership within the Compass organization comes back and says, you know, you're right. You're right. We really need to go that direction. You're running Morrison, or you're running one of the other sectors. You need to execute on it and deliver the bottom line that we've all promised. So we've been successful because you've got great leadership in both organizations that respect each other at a high level that says, okay, we're all trying to get the same place. If we happen to disagree, that's okay. Let's do the push and pull, the give and take, and then whatever way is the best way to get there, we're all going to align ourselves to be able to accomplish that.
I call that the leadership tango.
Yeah.
Other people
yes,
call
indeed.
It politics.
That's a very good analogy.
So let's talk a little bit about your industry. Perhaps the food business may not be well known to some of our listeners. It is an industry in which acquisitions have taken place worldwide,
yes.
as well as locally here in the U.S. for many, many years. And you've described some of your growth through that acquisition. Talk a little bit about what makes up the food industry. What might surprise a listener, or what might be an education about the food industry that perhaps being the role of the CFO, they might not think?
There's two things that I really learned coming into the food industry. One, I thought food industry was going to be very easy. It's not. It has very thin margins, and how you provide food in a high quality level in a hospital, a senior living community, a ballpark, university are all going to be different. And you have to do it with excellence. And nobody wants the same meal every day the same way. So it's a continual innovation, and you have to respond to what's going on in the market. So it's a constant change. You can't, you know, with a widget, you can turn out the same widget, and then you can announce a product release 2 years later, and then you can turn that out for 2 years. You can't do that with food. If you go for 2 weeks, people are going
to... Baked beans for 2 weeks, they're not going to come back, right?
That's right. That's right. The other thing that I really learned is, and we know this, but it wasn't something that we realized, food has a tremendous impact on people. So in a hospital, food is part of the healing process. In a resident community, food is part of the environment as to why they want to be in that community as opposed to another community. So it's more than just food. So you have to incorporate all of that thinking into how are you serving our residents? How are you serving our patients in the midst of constant change? And at the same time, do it in a cost-effective way. That's much more complex than I ever anticipated before I went into the food industry.
So have you, in your work, you go out to the lines and you see the food, you see
yes.
the hospitals, and I understand you have some high security clearance, food giving, should I say.
Food giving, yes.
So for governments and so forth, there are very different aspects of food catering. In one scenario, you're talking about hundreds, thousands of people, perhaps in a hospital environment, or a university. I think you mentioned universities.
Mm-hmm.
Is the food industry a massive logistics situation?
It is. It is much more logistics than I ever thought, and therefore there's many players than what you would have thought before. The manufacturers or the companies like a Kellogg or a General Mills that provide food. Then you have the distributors that are there. Then you have the people that actually provide the service and take it from the box, if you will, to the plate, and that's where we would fit in. In that logistics, you also have to maintain a quality. You have to maintain nutritional value, especially in a hospital environment that we're in. You have to maintain quality food, so it's not nutritional, but it's also high quality that people want to eat healthy, nutritional food.
There's particularly in hospitals
Absolutely.
And universities for young students.
Yes. So we have to do that within Morrison's Hospital and Senior Living. Our partner company has to do that in universities. Another company does that in business and industry. And where you bring value is that we're not just a food company. We incorporate the healing of patients, the lifestyle improvement of our residents. Our sister companies incorporate that into the quality of food service for students in universities or associates in business and industry. That's where you can add the value and do it in an innovative way. You want your client to say, I've never thought of that.
Very unique. And talking a little bit, taking that one step further, we have logistics, a very specific element of food's got to be there, ready, at the right temperature, in the right environment, and for purposes of being part of that nurturing, healthy aspect for the person who's eating it. Let's take that one step further in terms of the finance function for this. Is it very systematic, or does it tend to be, in terms of that role that you have of finance and reporting, does that become more out of the box? Is every month, does it have an unusual oddity because of the manner of the business, or does it become perhaps logistically repetitive?
In the food industry, especially because of the clientele that we serve, our clientele, that is different to provide food service in a hospital that is children focused as opposed to a hospital that is cardiac focused or a maternity wing or residents in different communities. You really have to flex with the environment. And then you can be in this. So you look at one of our clients, you've really just seen one of our clients, and you have to deliver a plan on delivering quality food to that client, to their needs, the way they are in their market. Then you have curveballs that come. So when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, our hospital clients still had to provide service. Our employees went above and beyond the normal. Our business partners, from a logistics standpoint, to get food to hospitals for patients that are still there, went above and beyond the normal. So how do you flex with that? That involves finance, because you still have to pay the bills. You still have to get paychecks to individuals, and our parent company does our payroll. You still have to get paychecks to individuals that are still working, and you still have to have money to buy food. Even if for logistical reasons, maybe something didn't get there in time, if you're going to go down the street and be able to get water to serve patients, you have to have money in order to do that if ATM machines aren't working. So you not only have to manage the uniqueness of every client, but you have to flex within the finance function the uniqueness of whatever curveballs may come. And every client financially, you have to look at it as an individual client. And that's a real challenge.
And within that, you've talked, perhaps without saying the words, but very much about contingency planning. Plan B, plan C for what you didn't even know was going to occur.
Yes.
Is that a big strategic element of the CFO role?
Yes. I think it's not only strategic planning, but knowing that it could change tomorrow. So that flexibility, knowing from a financial role, being able to say, it's not going to be just the way we've always done it, or this is how we do this. So financially, for example, with Morrison, when you're looking at one client and you know this is how we value the relationship with that one client, the economics of that client, we have to be flexible enough to say that's not the way it's going to be at every client. Every client's going to be different, and therefore the finance function has to deliver to the operational leadership the answers and the information they need that's specific to that client. How do you do that without trying to over-standardize, if you will?
And in that regard, you're now part of an international company.
Yes.
Have you expanded internationally? I certainly don't want to ask you about future plans. You're publicly held. But today, are you focused purely on the U.S., or do you have any impact from those foreign markets?
Morrison itself is purely in the United States. Compass itself is in 50 countries, as we had mentioned earlier. So there's continual exposure to different markets, and Compass obviously is continuing to look at all different markets.
And obviously in today's world, the widgets that one buys, and for you, the food that you buy, I would imagine a substantial portion of that may have originated from the U.S., but some perhaps originates from outside.
Yes.
You know, when we grew up many, many years ago, you had cyclical food. You know, asparagus came at a certain time of the year, apples came at a certain time of the year, and for three quarters of the year, you didn't get the rest of it.
That's right.
But today you've got to be able to have a worldwide logistics arm, I would imagine.
Yes, and Compass Group has done a great job. They've taken that procurement, logistics, and food supply chain, put it all into one organization, and you have experts dedicated to that. So just like finance serves with flexibility and the ability to add value to the organization, they serve our internal customer of operations leadership. Our organization that's on the procurement and the food supply chain side serves the organization by everything you just said. They do an amazing job. We've shifted to cage-free eggs. We had talked about CSR a little bit earlier. To do some of the massive shifts that they've been able to accomplish is just amazing. And you can only do that with size. They've been remarkable at what they've been able to provide.
So true benefits of synergies of that large corporation and the multi-country aspect of that.
Sourcing food from all over the world.
That's fabulous. Well, Tony, I must say it's a shame that we have come towards the end of the show, but we have. We have a tradition on the show to ask you your CFO tip of the month. What is yours?
Mine would be, and I'm going to quote Colin Powell here. He has a quote that says, "Leadership is the art of accomplishing more than the science of management says is possible." So I would say to the listeners, go do the impossible through leadership.
That is a phenomenal tip. Thank you very much, Tony. And
thanks
to Tony Mitchell, our guest today, for sharing your innermost thoughts on the role of the CFO. It's been a true pleasure. And thank you also to our contributor for the news article earlier, and to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, go to www.delaneyllc.com. SAP Business by Design, the software as a service business management solution for small to medium-sized companies. For more information on their products, go to www.sap.com/SME. And last but not least, Financial Executive International, the preeminent association for CFOs and financial executives. Their website is financialexecutives.org. This and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO or know of one that would like to be a guest on the show, please contact us via the web. And thank you for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off until next time.